What if, instead of creating the state of Israel after World War II, the Allies went with FDR's plan to create a Jewish state in southern Alaska? Michael Chabon wrote a novel about that in 2007. The Coen brothers snapped up the rights, and then nothing happened, which makes Scott Bunn wonder.
Why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we can rip from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it on the big screen. I'm Mike Vago, author and regular contributor to the AV Club. And this week I'm joined by Scott Bunn, who hosts indie sports radio show Steve Sack Syndrome on Asheville FM, North Carolina community radio station. You can also listen to it at AshevilleFM.org. Scott, thanks for coming on the show. Tell us a little bit about your show, and then we'll get into why the Coens need to get moving on this adaptation.
Oh, yeah. Steve Sack Syndrome is a show, as you said, on Asheville FM, which is, I live in Asheville, North Carolina. It's a community radio station. And my co-host and I, Tom Chalmers, we do a weekly sports radio talk show. We call it Indie Sports Radio. It's a way for us just to talk about good stories that come out of sports. So we definitely do analysis and breakdown of, you know, the games that happened on Sunday afternoon or the NBA finals. But also we like to talk to people about their own interactions with sports, whether as a player or as a fan or as a coach or some other strange stuff. So we really enjoy it. And we've had you, Mike Vago, on Steve Sack Syndrome a few times.
That's right. I did a story that I might do a podcast episode of about the 1904 Olympics and how it went hilariously wrong. And I was also going to say about your show, you also will talk about like volleyball sometimes and tennis and like, you know, it's not sports shouting from 30 Rock. It's sort of an intellectual approach, and you get a lot of personal stories and stuff that you don't necessarily get from ESPN, which I appreciate.
Yeah. The best thing that we've heard about our show is people who have said, I don't like sports at all, but I love listening to your show.
Yeah. That's the best endorsement you can get. Anyway, so Yiddish Policeman Union was a Michael Chabon book from 2007.
Yeah, that's correct.
And he's best known for writing The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, and he's the showrunner on Star Trek Discovery now. But he's one of our great literary, you know, people. And then, of course, the Coens, the most accomplished directors alive. So they almost made this happen. The Coens bought the rights. They were talking about this. It never happened. So tell us about the book. Tell us about why it needs to be a movie.
Well, you described it pretty well in that this is kind of an alternative history version of the present day. I'm reading some of this from Wikipedia, credit where credit is due, based on the premise that during World War II, a temporary settlement for Jewish refugees was established in Sitka, Alaska in 1941, and that the fledgling state of Israel was destroyed in 1948. So the novel itself is set in present day Sitka, Alaska, and it depicts a large Yiddish-speaking metropolis. So it's a big city, sort of. I always pictured it as being kind of like Toronto, only in Alaska. But the key point is that the population there speaks Yiddish, but also the movie is a detective story, so it's kind of a noir. And so the feeling, I guess, is kind of like that. At least the setting. I don't know if you ever saw Insomnia, directed by Christopher Nolan with Robin Williams and Al Pacino, set in Alaska. But it was kind of like a noir detective story set in Alaska. So it's a same kind of feel, only not rural. Like picture a large city with millions of people in Alaska.
And I got the feeling from reading it that a lot of Chabon's, maybe not his reason for writing it, but he seemed very interested in how can I marry like hard-boiled detective, you know, Raymond Chandler kind of dialogue with like really Jewy, colorful Yiddish expressions?
Yeah, that's right. Well, and I wanted to step back, first of all, just talking about Chabon. He kind of feels like one of our guys, you know, of our generation, where he grew up being influenced by television, movies, comic books, as well as sort of quote-unquote high literature. And so, you know, when he reached that sort of popularity, he was able to do anything. And so he said, great, I'm going to write a noir detective story, but I'm going to do it with his own slant. And I'm going to read this from Wikipedia, because I think it's actually key to not only the book, but this sort of imagined adaptation that we're talking about. So Chabon was inspired by an essay that he published in Harper's in October 1997. And so the essay was called guidebook to a land of ghosts, and it discussed a travel book that Chabon had found, which was called Say It in Yiddish, and the dearth of Yiddish-speaking countries in which the book would be useful. So while researching this hypothetical Yiddish-speaking countries, Chabon learned about what you talked about, the FDR proposal to put Jewish refugees in Alaska during World War II. And so the idea came out of, you know, this sort of speculative idea actually from history, but this, the imagination takes hold from the idea of like, oh, this would be a great to have a Yiddish-speaking population in Alaska.
And I remember Chabon saying at the time, there was some moment of decision when the state of Israel was formed about what is our official language, is it Hebrew or Yiddish? And he talked a little bit about how there's sort of a high and low culture associated with those languages, that Hebrew is a lot more sort of formal and respectable, and Yiddish is very slangy and sort of a polyglot language that pulls from all these other sources. And so they decided, they went high and decided to go with Hebrew. So part of this is also like, how would this affect our culture if Yiddish was still the thing that most Jewish people spoke and that the Jewish state, you know, spoke?
And it's played out in the novel. You can see it in the writing that, you know, he loves writing a noir detective story, but he also very much is like, how can I use these kind of Yiddish expressions and idioms while writing this book?
So I guess let's get into the plot a little bit of the book, because there's a, you know, it's a noir detective story. Detective, the main character is Meyer Landsman, who's, you know, drunk, washed up detective, kind of a Jewish Alaskan McNulty. And and he has to investigate a murder and then kind of digs deeper, and there's a lot more going on. His boss is also his ex-wife, Bina Landsman. His partner is half Tlingit, which is one of the like Native American nations in that part of Alaska. Gurko Shemitz, who's half Jewish, half Tlingit. I hope I'm saying that right. So there's also this thing going on where basically the Native Americans are kind of taking the place of the Palestinians, that this is their land, this is sort of their ancestral land, and all these other people have been settled. Although I think Chabon sort of charitably imagines a world where they get along a little bit better.
Right. And then, so there's this kind of pending idea that in the sort of setting of the novel, that Sitka, while being a large population, which has kind of been operating as an independent state, would become part of the state of Alaska. So there's just this sense of unease and tension within the population, not only within the Jewish population that's there, but also with the Native Americans who are there as well, and just uncertainty about what's coming. I guess it's kind of like Brexit is a kind of interesting analogy as well.
Yeah, one of my frustrations with the book, to be honest, is that he introduces these larger geopolitical ideas. If I remember, the Alaska thing was like FDR gave them a 50-year lease, and that was about to expire.
Right.
And so the land was going to go back to Alaska, and they had to decide, like, do we want to be Americans in, you know, part of Alaska, or do we want to do our own thing? But then there's also like an attempt that's kind of in the background. It's like on the news about like another attempt to rebuild, like to reclaim Israel for the Jews.
Right.
And then there's all, it also gets into these very religious ideas about the return of the Messiah, and this idea, which I don't know Judaism well enough to know if this is a thing Chabon invented or whether this is a time-honored thing, but that every year there's sort of somebody who has the potential to be the Messiah, and right. It just so far it's never been that guy, like whoever it is. And so he explores a lot of really weighty themes, but doesn't really resolve any of them. And they kind of, like, the story opens up these grand ideas, and then by the end it's just like, hey, I solved a murder and I got the girl. The end.
Yeah, and not wanting to give away too much of the plot, but the sort of murder victim that he is investigating, it ties into those larger ideas that you're talking about the sort of chosen one or the Messiah, but also still within the idea of like the crime underworld of this community as well, with the crime boss being, you know, this kind of shadowy figure throughout this whole thing. So you talk about your own frustrations with the plot. And so for me, I actually don't mind so much about those things. I think this is our kind of rift about this novel, is that I just love being in the world. And that was, I think, what was obvious, that that's really all Chabon really cared about. He didn't care so much about the plot. It was, I want to do noir. I want to do Yiddish-speaking people in Alaska. And I want to have this sense of unease. And so that's what I really loved, was being in the world. And so I would love to see that translated to the big screen.
Well, I think the Coens are exactly able to do it too, because they also seem to be far more interested in inhabiting a world than giving you a strong ending. Because a lot of their recent films, you know, like Hail Caesar was so much about just doing the pastiche of, you know, old movies and love letter to old Hollywood. And the plot doesn't really make a whole lot of sense and doesn't really have much of a conclusion. It's other than just like, hey, everything keeps going.
And so my feeling about this, like, imaginary adaptation is that this movie isn't so much comic in tone like a lot of their movies. You mentioned Hail Caesar, which kind of feels like a madcap romp. I want it to be more in the Miller's Crossing, No Country for Old Men feeling. Even though there's potential for comedy, I want it to be a dark comedy, and the tone is still dark. Would you agree with me, or do you have a different take on that?
No, I think that's a good way to do this, but they're also very good at putting wry humor in their darkest stuff.
Yes.
And even the storyline, like, you, I don't think this is even as comical and light as, like, Fargo.
No.
Which is, you know, like, William H. Macy's character is still kind of an absurd figure. There isn't really, maybe Meyer Landsman, the detective, is a little bit of an absurd figure to a tiny bit, just because, like, he's a fuck-up and he knows he's a fuck-up.
Right.
Which is just, again, makes him such a good Coens character.
So if we can just, talking about the Coens and their sort of what they've done till now, I've always been interested with this idea about how they kind of establish the sort of framing, the setting of some of their movies. This is more pronounced in some movies more than others, but I think it's actually there. They start a lot of their movies with a monologue or a voiceover that kind of serves as a thesis statement that establishes sort of the setting, the particular language, vernacular feeling of the movie. It's one of my favorite things about sitting down to watch a new Coen Brothers movies, to see, like, okay, how are they going to set this? And I realized that it's actually taken directly from The Godfather. If you remember, The Godfather starts where Marlon Brando, as the Godfather, is receiving all of these people on the day of his wedding, where he can't sort of refuse an offer. But it actually starts with The Undertaker, I'm going to start with my voices, where he says, I believe in America. America has made my fortune, and I raised my daughter in the American fashion. I gave her freedom, but I taught her never to dishonor her family. She found a boyfriend, not an Italian, and on and on and on. And so from there, you know, it, exactly, immediately where you are in The Godfather. But that first line, I believe in America, that's what that whole trilogy is about, in the first, very first line spoken by an Italian immigrant. And so the Coens do that, but in lots of different ways. So, Mike, before I move on, anything about The Godfather?
Just that's such a great, you know, thesis statement.
Yeah.
And it also cuts between, after that speech, it cuts between Don Corleone,
yeah,
and Luca Brasi sort of fumbling through the speech he's going to give to Don Corleone about, like,
right,
thank you for inviting me to your daughter's wedding on the day of your daughter's wedding.
And I hope that child will be a masculine child. Yes. So here we go. It's the opportunity for us to do all these voices.
But it is a tremendous, like, thesis statement for the movie, I Believe in America. It's such a great, it's one of the classic opening lines.
It's a terrific opening line. And so what's so great is that, you know, there's often been this thing, like, I took screenwriting in college, and in theater, there's always this thing of, like, yeah, use the language. That's the core part of what the play is coming from. But screenplays, you know, you're sort of drilled into it. You know, film is a visual medium. Don't rely so much on the language. The Coens don't care about that. So, you know, a lot of people think that voiceovers are crutches. the Coens say, voiceovers are an excellent opportunity to talk about what we want to talk about. So they don't worry about that. In fact, play with it. So Raising Arizona, which is their second major film, it starts with Nicolas Cage's voiceover, which again sort of drops you immediately into the world that this is. So he says, you hear the banjo in the background, and he says, "My name is H.I. McDonough. Call me High. The first time I met Ed," and then it's just off. And you hear this Arizona kind of rednecky voice, and the banjo's playing in the background, and you just know you're in this Looney Tunes cartoon as soon as that voiceover starts.
Before you go to the next Coen, one of my favorite openings for a movie is Trainspotting. It doesn't open immediately with the Choose Life speech. It opens with running footsteps.
Yes.
Because it cuts in between, as he's narrating his life as a junkie, one of the scenes it cuts between is him running away from the police and then getting hit by a car and then kind of laughing it off and just gets this sort of giddy, destructive. By the time Lust for Life stops playing, you know exactly who these people are and what their life is. But it also, it literally hits the ground running. And the Choose Life speech just That's grabs great. You and you're in that world immediately. And I love movies that start that way. Books that start that way too. But like, I love a story where you're just like, we're in the car, we're going 60 miles an hour. You know, you're in it right now.
Yeah. And so the next one is Miller's Crossing, which I sort of cited as like the tone. And it actually starts with a monologue, not a voiceover, but you hear the voice first. And then, and there's glasses clinking together. And it's this gangster character, Johnny Caspar, who is played by the late John Polito, who is just a great character actor in a lot of Coen Brothers movies. And he says, "I'm talking about friendship. I'm talking about character. I'm talking about, hell, Leo, I ain't embarrassed to use the words. I'm talking about ethics. You know, I'm a sporting man. I like to make the occasional bet, but I ain't that sporting." And you're just in it immediately. And the idea of like ethics, you know, he says it with that sort of hard Italian, not saying the TH. And so you're already into the world of double crossing and conflicted loyalties that Miller's Crossing is all about by this idea about ethics. And he's a gangster character. He doesn't have anything about ethics. And it's laid out in the script that follows, in the movie that follows. But it's all right there in that world.
That's such good writing. As you're going through these, and I'm looking at the filmography of the Coens, it really hits me that they, not dialogue, is the word I'm looking for, dialect.
Yes.
They really use dialect almost as their setting.
Yeah.
Just think about how many movies are just hung on, Fargo hangs on that Minnesota, well, don't you know, kind of thing. And like, you know, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is like yes. these 30s sort of fast-talking Southern thing. Intolerable Cruelty, which is not one of their favorite, you know, one of their favorite movies by the fans, but they do this sort of screwball comedy, you know, banter. And actually, Hudsucker Proxy is probably a better example. Hudsucker Proxy, they have that screwball comedy banter down. And so many of their, you know, No Country for Old Men is that sort of sparse Western.
Yeah.
So many of these things are just based on, this is the way a certain segment of the population talks. Let's get into that. And we'll build a story around that.
Can I do one more?
Of course, yeah.
So this is one of my favorite openings, is from The Big Lebowski. And it's Sam Elliott, who's only shows up on screen once. And he's this kind of fantasy figure. But again, they're using this monologue voiceover as a way to set it up. This might go a little long. You cut out as much as you want, but it's just, I love doing the voice. "Away out west, there was a fella I want to tell you about, fella by the name of Jeff Lebowski. This Lebowski, he called himself the Dude. Now the Dude, there's a name no one self-apply where I come from." Here, I'll skip ahead, but he said, "And I'm talking about the Dude here. Sometimes there's a man, well, he's the man for his time and place. He fits right there, and that's the Dude in Los Angeles. Sometimes there's a man, well, sometimes there's a man." And this is all happening while the Tumbling Tumbleweeds is playing in the background, which is totally, so this is a Western figure, Sam Elliott. He's like the quintessential Western actor, Tumbling Tumbleweeds is a Western song, and they're looking at Los Angeles. So immediately you're thinking, okay, this is a Western, but this is a city. But the voiceover establishes that this man is the hero of our story, but not a traditional hero, just like LA isn't a traditional setting for a Western. And it's not even a Western, it's a private detective movie. So the Coens are playing with all of those things at once. And going back to what you're saying, we have the language of Sam Elliott, the sort of a dialect, the vernacular of the Western. Then you have the dude who is, you know, a typical Southern California burnt out hippie, and we're getting his story in Los Angeles. But this is why they are the perfect people to make an adaptation of the Yiddish Policeman's Union, to use, like Chabon himself said, the language was his starting place for creating this world. And so the Coens are the ones who should be creating this world of Sitka.
Yeah, it's such a perfect marriage. Like, usually on the show, we have some discussion about who can direct, and like to throw out a couple names, but even if they hadn't already bought the rights to the movie, like, just nobody makes as much sense.
It's true. I want to watch it.
Yeah, we don't even have to have a discussion with directors. So let's talk about the cast.
Okay.
Should I run through the characters first, and then we can talk about each one?
Yeah, do that.
All right, so Meyer Landsman is the main character. He's the detective, and he's a screw-up at his job, but he is trying to redeem himself by solving this murder. Bina Landsman is his ex-wife. She might have taken her maiden name. I don't remember from the book. But Bina is his ex-wife, and she's now maybe not the police chief, but his boss in the police department. Berko Shemitz is his partner, who's half Tlingit, half Jewish. Hertz Shemitz is Berko's father, who makes a couple of appearances. He has a crucial role in the plot later on, but just like an older Jewish character we need at some point. Willie Dick is the Tlingit police chief from, I guess, the neighboring police department, because he's more in the like Native Alaskan side of Sitka. Rabbi Spielman is the crime boss and also the rabbi. And there's a fantastic scene, which, again, you can just see the Coens, where there's this room full of rabbis who are running a syndicate, but they're also scrutinizing the Torah looking for loopholes because they have to live everything according to the rules. But there are all these things where, like, you know, well, on the Sabbath, you can go through a doorway. Well, two telephone poles and a, you know, wire over, that's a doorway, right? They take God's rules very, very seriously. But they also want to find a way to get around it that God's not going to notice. So it is this kind of very dryly comic scene in this comic figure. His son, Mendel Spielman, is the murder victim, who is, I think, a young man of his early 20s. And I think that's, am I forgetting anybody? That's sort of the basic cast.
Those are the main ones, yeah.
All right, well, so let's talk about Meyer Landsman.
Okay, I can't wait to share this with you. So I first want to say that, again, this is not a comic movie in my vision of it. It's dark, but there still needs to be room for comedy. So you know who should play Meyer Landsman? Marc Maron.
That's great.
Like, he's the perfect person. You know, he's getting his acting chops together. I think he's terrific on GLOW. I love the podcast, of course, but he's an alcoholic. He's a recovering alcoholic, so he's seen that life. Like, he can play a beaten down guy, and that's who needs to play in this part.
And he can do very put upon, which you kind of need to be as a noir detective.
Exactly, but he can also play those comic moments when needed. Also, he's a Jew, and he also is just exactly. He can play that sort of that tone right in the middle there. And I also know just from listening to WTF that he is a giant Coen Brothers fan.
Yeah, that, you know what? I don't even know if I'm going to bring up my suggestions because they're very pedestrian compared to that.
Bring it on. I would hear it.
I mean, I had just thinking about this as a noir detective story, you kind of want somebody who can carry that. Because I was looking at like, You do, this is a very Jewish story, you kind of want Jewish actors. But I was thinking about people about the right age, and I don't really have a strong sense of how old this guy is. He's old enough to be kind of a beaten down, you know, alcoholic with an ex-wife and all that sort of thing. So I'm thinking sort of 40s or 50s. So I was thinking maybe Leah Schreiber, because he's got like sort of action, not action movie sort of Arnold Schwarzenegger type action movie chops, but he's been the tough guy, and he's kind of the indie action movie guy. And I was thinking, if you want to go a little younger movie, Jake Gyllenhaal, you know, in Nightcrawler mode. But I can just hear Maron just making a meal of the dialogue.
Yeah.
And, you know, for all the reasons you, yeah, that's a much better. And also, another issue that I had with trying to age Meyer Landsman is that his ex-wife, who is old enough to be the police chief or the lieutenant or whatever she is, you know, old enough to be sort of a higher up in this police department. And also, it's a Coen Brothers movie. You've got to have Frances McDormand in there. It has to be somebody who could credibly be married to Frances McDormand. And so Maron works for that, too. You know, she's, well, I think, about 63. He's in his late 50s.
I see them together. I like that. But I do have an alternative for Landsman's ex-wife, which is Gina Gershon.
Huh.
I love her. She's also sort of age-appropriate with Maron. And I think she was on his show, Maron, though I didn't watch it. So, you know, full disclosure. But I kind of like just her. I think she's beautiful, but she's also not like 23 years old beautiful. You know, she is distinctly middle-aged, which I think this character needs to be, but she also needs to be a tough cop. Like, she's supervising cops, so she needs to be tough and arresting and in charge.
I have to say, this was actually the toughest role for me to try to cast, other than Frances McDormand, because I didn't want to have other alternatives. Because you need to find somebody who can be the love interest and can be the tough cop and is the right age range and is Jewish, and like there's kind of a lot of boxes to check.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, and she checks a lot of them. It's a great choice.
So I do want to talk about Berko Shemets. Mine is a little bit controversial, so I'm kind of like open to suggestions on this. So you mentioned that he's half Native American, half Jewish. I did go with a Jew in this role, and it is decidedly, he comes from a comic background. Again, I think this actor working in a sort of dark comedy role, noir role, actually works pretty well to play off of Maron. It's Seth Rogen.
You know, as Jewy as this movie is, I was trying to figure out where we can put Seth Rogen in here.
Yes.
It's also been a while since I read the book, and I forget how much Berko's a comic character. I feel like he's kind of the straight-laced one. Like, he's the good cop.
Yeah.
Not that Rogen couldn't do a serious role.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, but that's what I was... So part of it is because I heard Marc Maron and Seth Rogen talk about Seth Rogen's new movie, American Pickle, on WTF, and they went really deep on, you know, Jewish identity in America and everything. It was a fascinating conversation. It was really great. And I just think they have a good rapport. And so you're right. I couldn't remember how he played in the book, but I thought just the pairing of Rogen as a decidedly younger person than Meyer Landsman and Marc Maron, that might be just a fun pairing.
That's true. Yeah, no, that is a good parallel. I went in a very different direction. I was worried this was too on the nose, but Zal McLaren was on the TV adaptation of Fargo, which is sort of Coen's adjacent. But he was terrific as like a ruthless hitman. He's half Native American, half Irish, and he's taken in by this crime family. He played Hansi on season 2.
Season 2. That's right. I know who you're talking about. Actually, that's a really good choice.
Yeah, he was so good in that, and the kind of actor who, like, one of my sort of, I guess, motivations for doing this show is there's so many actors out there that you're like, why aren't they in more stuff?
Right.
So part of this is just me dreaming up like roles for these people who should, you know, who need to be in more stuff. And he was one of my guys after that season of Fargo.
That's great. I love it. I co-sign.
So Hertz Shemets is his father, who.
Well, is the victim's father.
No, Hertz Shemets is Berko's father.
Oh, okay.
And so there's this couple scenes that sort of contrast, like Berko has this warm family life. Again, he's the good cop. And Meyer has sort of screwed up his marriage and doesn't have kids. And so you have Hertz as sort of the doting father, but then he sort of ends up timing the plot later on. So you want somebody sort of consequential. And I was also looking at a list of people the Coen would like to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking Stephen Tobolowsky there.
Because
he's been in a bunch of Coen movies, And he is sort of the genial, warm family man figure, but he could also do darker, more serious if he has to.
I think the
plot requires him to do it at one juncture.
I like that. I also wondered about Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, that's a good. I was trying to think about, like, can we get him in here somewhere?
Yeah.
So that might be the spot.
Yeah, I also don't think that Goldblum's been in a Coen Brothers movie, and I'd love to see him just doing that dialogue. And how can they use Jeff Goldblum's particular energy?
Just his
in
Jeff
a way.
Goldblum-ness.
Yes.
Well, actually, let's go to Rabbi Spielman, who's the rabbinical crime boss, because that was another place where I was thinking Jeff Goldblum. But maybe that's too on the nose.
My suggestion, I have two. First, did you ever see the HBO series Luck? It was a David Milch project after Deadwood.
They canceled it because too many horses got killed on set.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's right. But Dustin Hoffman played a gangster type figure, and he was very good, very restrained, very quiet. And so I thought that Dustin Hoffman in this role, again, he's probably only in three scenes, you know, so it's one of those kind of best supporting actor type roles where they're in three scenes, but they're so menacing and terrifying, you think they're in the whole movie.
And you can probably get Dustin Hoffman for that.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and Joel Coen on the other end of the phone, he probably says yes to that.
Exactly. And so, again, like Dustin Hoffman working with Coen Brothers' language and dialogue, I really want to see that. The other option was, if you can't get Dustin Hoffman, James Caan is a thing, tying back to The Godfather.
Yeah, and Jewish mob bosses, that almost too on the nose.
It's a little too on the nose, but he plays it a little bit more straight and menacing, whereas I think Dustin Hoffman could be slightly comic.
He's a little more of a character.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, actually, I have another suggestion too, which is maybe even more of a character. And this is like, this guy's not remotely Jewish, but he's such a Coen's guy, Stephen Root.
Oh, yeah.
And you've seen on Barry, he is this absurd figure, but he also has this real menace.
I would watch that. I love him in everything. He is one of the great American character actors we have. And yeah, perfect. I want him somewhere in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. So that might be a good spot. Although if we can get Dustin Hoffman, it's kind of hard to say no to.
Yeah.
In our theoretical, you know, casting room. So two more small roles. Willie Dick is the Tlingit police chief who, you know, he's just kind of the guy in the noir who, like, gives the occasional tip to the detective. I just want to throw in Gary Farmer, who was in Dead Man. And he's also Native Canadian, which is kind of Alaska adjacent. And, you know, I know you also love Dead Man, the old Jim Jarmusch, you know, acid western, I think you called it. And he's just another guy. Like, there aren't that many Native American actors who, you know, are sort of getting recognition and need more work. And he's a guy who I would love to see in more stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're only pulling from a small list of people. But yeah, I like Gary Farmer. I was also thinking about Wes Studi. He was in Heat. He was also in Last of the Mohicans. I've always liked his acting and just not in enough stuff. And so I think he could also do this. I've always liked him in Heat in a very small role, playing off of Pacino, who's crazy and pretending to be on cocaine. So I think it actually kind of works for, like, that kind of energy works in this movie.
And he was also very dryly funny in Mystery Men.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot he was.
Because, yeah, he was on my list for this character, too. And then the only person left is Mendel Spielman, who's the murder victim. Maybe you want to see him in flashbacks, because the sort of investigation into the murder is the investigation into this guy's life and sort of what brought him to the low place where he's killed. And so I think he's in his maybe early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I was just joking to somebody else, a future guest, that I don't know that many young actors, so I just always go to the cast of Stranger Things.
Yes.
And in particular, Finn Wolfhard, because it's just fun to say, get me Finn Wolfhard. But he's Jewish, he's the right age, and Mendel is, I think at the time of his murder, he's also a junkie, so it's kind of the mystery of, like, he's like a high-achieving kid who ends up being strung out, and his sort of life falls apart, and then he's murdered. So part of the mystery isn't just who killed him, but it's also, like, what went wrong with this kid? And so I can see him playing kind of a brilliant young teenager whose life goes wrong, I also have Ezra Miller on my list from when you talk about Cabin in the Parks being a wallflower.
Oh, yeah.
Who, you know, I think has the depth to do that. Because, again, this is somebody who has to sell a pretty complicated backstory in a couple of flashbacks.
Yeah, and they also have to potentially be the Messiah.
Well, yeah. Spoiler alert. That was...
Spoiler alert. My apologies to everybody out there listening.
But you know what? It's a 10-year-old book. No, but we talked about that at the beginning, that one of the themes that Shaban goes into is that there's, you know, there are people who have the potential to be the Messiah.
Yeah.
And I can't really get into it as well as he does. That, like, and he's this brilliant chess player and this brilliant guy who buckles under the pressure of these expectations, because you get the feeling that if he lived in Cleveland, even if he were this guy with the potential, it wouldn't be in his face every minute of every day.
Yeah, and I don't think that's actually a spoil, because let's just say that there are many parts of this book that aren't quite resolved.
Yeah, and I said at the beginning that was part of my frustration with the book, but it is also a very Coen's thing about it.
Yeah. So just knowing this cast and knowing what we talked about in terms of like how they like to set up the world, set up the characters... So think about Marc Maron doing a voiceover to establish like this Jewish state in Alaska of all places, and then some sort of monologue, some kind of voiceover, but then it opens, as you said, with a bunch of, you know, old Jews in this place where they're playing chess. And for me, that is just the perfect opening to a Coen Brothers movie starring a lot of these folks, but especially Marc Maron.
Yeah, this all just fits together. Yeah, so make this movie.
I know.
Get Joel Coen. Get him on the phone right now.
We have to email him the link to this podcast. Again, what do you need? A roadmap here?
Well, exactly. Yes. I'm definitely tagging both the Coen brothers on Twitter in this one.
We need to tag Maron.
Oh, that's true. Oh my God, yeah. Because you know what? He could get that made. Like, he could probably make that call.
He's starting to get the juice.
Has he interviewed the Coens yet? That's probably his excuse to get him in a room and pitch this to him.
I think he's always wanted to.
So why is this not a movie? Why is this not a Maron interview? There's a lot of things that need to happen coming from this podcast. But yeah, there's some episodes where like, this is a fun idea. It's kind of silly, blah, blah, blah. This one, no, seriously, make this movie.
I think we've laid it all out. And now part of me is wondering, would it be better than my imagination? But what's great about the Coen brothers is you can never really imagine what's going to happen on the screen. That's what you want out of watching a movie. When you sit down and you're like, I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen next. You know, most of the time they're able to pull it off and you're just like, that is singular. It is absolutely unique. And then sometimes you're like, that was okay. But that one scene was hilarious and great. And so I feel like even though I've read this book and I know this book really pretty well, I feel like they could create this world that I thought, God, I didn't see that coming at all.
Well, you mentioned earlier about how, you know, sort of film is a visual medium and they teach you that in screenwriting class, but there's so much about dialogue. But there's also so much about film as a visual medium. You know, they have all those gorgeous Roger Deakins cinematography early on. But they're also so good at using visuals. Like, Wes Anderson gets more talked about, but they're also as meticulous in building just all the little details that make up a scene and make a setting and really give you a feel for where you are. And so, you know, they attack movies from every angle and they put so much thought into everything they do. So even as good as the idea is in your head, they're going to bring something to it that you didn't expect, and they're going to add some level to it that you didn't think was there.
We mentioned WTF a few times, but listen to Marc Maron's interview with Josh Brolin talking about No Country for Old Men and Hail Caesar. Listen to his interview with J.K. Simmons about Burn After Reading, and you can get a sense of that the Coens are looking for something very specific out of their actors. And so, yeah, they know what they want going into the casting and production.
We just need to make them want this. All right, so that's our movie. If you have any thoughts on the Coens taking on this Michael Chabon book and who else should be in it and who else Marc Maron should interview, because we're now taking over his podcast too, hit us up on Twitter at YMovie. You can also find my column, Wiki Wormhole, in the AV Club every Sunday. You can find this show and other wonderful content on subjectmedia.org, and you can go to my first novel, Self-Destructible, on your local bookstore. You can hear Steve Saxenbaum on AshevilleFM.org, and you just moved your time slot. So when is the show on live?
It's on live at Wednesdays at 7 p.m., same as it ever was.
But then it's archived on the AshevilleFM.org site, so you can listen to it anytime throughout the week. Best of both worlds. It's a whole new world for radio broadcasting. Oh, and I should plug, you can listen to my new radio show, History Lesson Part 2, on subjectmedia.org, where I just play some old stuff from the 90s and some new stuff and try to tie it all together. So that's it for our show. Stay safe out there. Wear a mask. Wash your hands. Keep yourself sane. We'll be back next time on...
Why is this not a movie?